what we're really looking for is like, who's primed to make that like box office hit, like once they're hired. And you don't know, you have to take some risks, but if you can, on the talent acquisition side, know how to identify that potential and pair that with talent development, who can increase the probability of that person following through to deliver something really special, that's worth, like, that's the make or break of a company.
Hello and welcome to the Making Better podcast, where we talk about how to make ourselves, our teams, and our organizations better. Whether you are a business leader, a talent development professional, or an individual contributor, this show will give you actionable insights to help improve your own performance and the performance of those around you. Today, our guests are Seika and Brian Major. This is the first time we've had two people on the podcast, so I'm really excited for the conversation. This husband and wife team are co-founders of Ad Astra, a company devoted to helping space and clean energy startups find the key talent that they need for their early hires. Brian was an engineer at SpaceX, and after his time there, he teamed up with Seika, who was in the talent acquisition industry, to help find highly technical talent who was passionate about the same things that they are. I'm really excited for this particular discussion because I think that talent development and talent acquisition often don't talk as much as we should. So in this episode, we talk about what talent development can do to help widen the talent pool for specific roles, the importance of culture clarity, how you can put a clear dollar amount on the impact of your training, and so much more. Before we get into the discussion, I do want to remind everybody that if this is your first time listening, make sure you hit subscribe so you never miss a future episode. And if you are already subscribed, then I humbly ask that you would share this show with at least one other person, because that is how we grow, and I cannot tell you how much it means to me. With that, let's get into the discussion with Seika and Brian Major. So Seika, I want you to be honest with me. When you were in companies doing, all your time in talent acquisition, how much time do you think you've really spent working with talent development teams?
Very little. Almost none.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of what I was expecting. That's definitely been my experience. And then, so to get a little bit different perspective to Brian, we both worked at SpaceX, when you've been in the businesses and teams and you're thinking about bringing people on to teams, you know, and that whole like buy it versus build it equation, how much of kind of the thought energy do you think goes into hiring compared to talent development on most teams?
It's a good question. I think it kind of has to be broken down into, are we thinking about hiring more junior talent that eventually steps into leadership roles? Or are we saying, oh, we have this person and we want to get them to this place, and how do we do that? I think a lot of companies are good at the first part, like, oh, let's hire a bunch of interns. It's like free interviewing, free validation of talent, or like we'll hire a lot of early career folks, and then like the cream of the crop will rise and take on more things. And there is a strong bias to do that in a lot of organizations, which I think can be really healthy. But I also don't know if there's that much infrastructure or support in directing someone into that role. You can end up with technical leaders, but without really any guidance on how to do a lot of the more management duties, for example.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's right. And that's been my experience as well. You know, before we were talking to the call or talking on the call, I was sharing with you that I find it so strange that, you know, both roles, talent development, talent acquisitions, they both say talent, but for some reason, like we never really talk very much. I've been in maybe, I don't know, I think I've seen maybe half a dozen at most companies where they have a big picture talent leader who is truly in charge of it all. But I don't know, if you go on to LinkedIn and looked up talent leader, typically they're talking about recruiting, like they're talking about the recruiting leader when they say that. Seika, you and I have had a lot of conversations in the past, or we had a conversation about this in the past. Like, I don't know, how does that affect the talent acquisition side of things?
Yeah, there are so many different directions that we can go with this. But yeah, a key one is, especially when we're talking about recruitment. So, right, what we do is very, very niche, very focused, startups, clean tech and space startups, right? Talent pool, not big. The people that we're able to pull in from other industries, it's tough to do once people have developed their career, either at legacy companies, it's really tough to get them into the into successfully integrated into a startup, or if they're coming from tech, it can be hard to get them, right? We need high reliability people. There's just a lot of nuance there. We want to get our talent pool bigger. What will happen at startups is, you know, you need somebody who can do the thing, who can own the thing. And the number of people who in the world, the number of people who can do that work, really small. Like sometimes we're talking in, you know, less than 10 people in the world that can do this job. And we go, you can sometimes find, you know, you contact all 10 of the people who can do the work right now, and none of them want to move to LA. Okay. So now we're talking about, you know, if we find somebody that's close to it, but they're not going to be able to really own this for 6 months. And the company says, well, we don't have the resources to put into developing and training this talent. So let's just keep looking. Well, the joke is it's going to take us 6 months to now go out and find that person when the talent pool is that small, right? And so if there was more integration and work that we can do on the talent development side of things, it really opens the pool up, and it helps us kind of work step in step and meet the market where it is.
Yeah, Brian, you're nodding your head a lot in that. It sounds like you've seen this firsthand quite a bit.
Yeah, I think the number of times that we've interacted with folks that like, oh, we really, really, really need this thing. And it's like, okay, well, here's 9 out of 10, or the market's like, this isn't available fully what you want. And the time and the trigger is not pulled. And it's they then get backed into this corner and then come back 6-12 months later and say, okay, let's do it. And you're like, we could have just done this, right? Like, time is so vital and these people are so capable of learning. Like, let's put them in that opportunity to learn and succeed and give them the tools and resources to be successful in that. And yeah, it comes up time and time again.
Where do you think that comes from? Because I could imagine a couple different things, but I often, in just my, you know, non-recruiting view of watching things, it seems like very often companies and leaders ultimately don't know what they're looking for or don't know what success is. So they're kind of like looking for certain badges that, you know, well, they worked at Apple, so they must be good at this, or they have this degree, they went to this school, so they must be good at this, rather than really being able to assess it themselves. And if they can't assess it themselves, then they certainly can't develop it themselves because they don't really know what makes someone good. Does that resonate at all, or are there other factors at play in that hesitancy?
I'd say that I think that definitely can be the case. I think that for a lot of the people that we work really closely with, they do have a pretty finely tuned meter of what they're looking for.
Great.
Sometimes what that covers, right, is like they need somebody that can do so much at a startup that it really makes the number of people who are capable of doing all of that really low, coupled with already having smaller talent pools. To answer your first question, and I don't know how to say this in a way that won't get me in trouble, so I'm just going to say it, is I think that in large part, talent development is looked at as a cost, right? That's expensive. And this is the part that might get me in trouble, is I think that in both of these arenas, both in talent acquisition and in talent development, there are people who are so excellent at this work, and there are a lot of people who are very not excellent at this work.
We talked about this. Yeah, there's no bar there's very little barrier or bar that's set for what good is that people can benchmark against.
Right. And so when leaders have sat through like bad acting videos that they're just trying to like fast forward to be able to check the box, yeah. like, yes, I did the training and like, you know, got, I'm trying to like, to kind of download something that can like click for me to get through this. Right. They go, I don't want to pay for that. As opposed to people who have had it done really well and they've been, cool, I'm able to like learn and develop and like gain new skills. I think that we can start to open up and get people excited about using that to fast track their team to higher level of productivity.
Yeah, that makes sense. And Brian, what has been your experience, you know, coming from that engineering background where, I don't know, there's many more kind of bars or degrees or like things that clearly denote that. When you moved from kind of that world in, now that you're more in the talent acquisition world, how have you seen that transition?
Let's see if I answer this directly or not, but we can circle back if I don't. But I think in engineering, it is a little bit easier to have this bar, right? There's a lot of binary. This was right, this was wrong. You know how to do this, you don't know how to do that. You know, you can put someone through a test and see how they succeed. And that's really challenging to do in these talent areas, like you're already discussing. What I think can be where I think it changes a lot is there sometimes you have this super duper niche role. You know, we hired an electromagnetic analyst before, right? Someone who can do extremely complicated multi-physics simulations in the electromagnetic space and then how it impacts the mechanical world. Like this is like highly
nobody knows what you're talking about anymore. Like it's so far beyond that. The words we don't even understand.
But that was the point, right? Like the point was that good luck, just like if you're gonna hire someone and train them to do that, like you're gonna need to set aside years to do it. So like
that's a really good point.
That role is like, yeah, we got to get the right like person who's at least maybe not 10 out of 10, but like maybe they're 8 or 9 out of 10 on the technical skills and they're 10 out of 10 with like the mentality side of things. But there's a lot of roles that are much more generalist. And I think it's in those areas that they say, oh, I want everything. But in reality, like, let's check a few boxes, prove that they're super competent and can do a lot of things. And then they're going to figure out the rest and, again, give them the tools and the resources because kind of going back to part of what we were talking about before, too, is, yeah, sometimes they really know what they want, but also what they really want can change. Like, the business needs change. The needs of the team change. So it's more about hiring for attitude and aptitude. Whenever you can, whenever these roles that you are less specific, so that way you can use talent development to get folks to where they need to be to ultimately support the business needs the best.
Yeah. I mean, since you all, like you said, you're hiring for these very, very often, very specific roles, like we're not going to, you know, you're not going to develop, almost no matter how big the company is, you're not going to develop a talent development strategy for teaching people how to be electromagnetic analysts. You know, it's just not going to happen. But kind of to that point and to the point that you made, Sega, of people seeing L&D as a cost center, from your perspective, I think there's a great opportunity to give, especially people in talent development, some clues as to what are a few things that are maybe the non-technical things that are the most common deficiencies or misses or something in candidates that if a company at least had these, it would dramatically or maybe at least somewhat increase their talent pool so that it would make that hiring process easier because we know we can cover these, I don't know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things. Like, are there any things that come to mind where that are frequently, maybe they just aren't quite ready for this yet, that if we could get them ready, it would really help the hiring process?
Yeah. First thing that comes to mind on the, for non-technical areas that I think there could be a lot of support are kind of on the cultural side of things or kind of the pace, autonomy, and ownership required to be successful in a lot of these roles, right? That we're going through a topic Brian's been talking about a lot recently is like a 1-3-1, right? Here, help me as if I do this incorrectly, but like concise outline of the problem, three potential paths forward, and my suggested path forward. And being able to use that sort of structure, bring like proactive solutions, figure out how to take ownership, right? We're not, these sort of environments aren't places where people can kind of like wait for a numbered list of priorities to be given to them by their supervisor or an outline of what they're going to be doing. Sometimes you'll have that, but often it's just, right, go forward, figure it out, you know, align well, and pieces like that, right? So that's non-technical. That does absolutely go the breadth of the organization, and it's something that makes it so that we can't pull in people from legacy companies, right? They don't have, it's just a very different kind of pace and design to that.
Yep. That makes that junior level where, and yeah, they just, anybody who doesn't have that ownership experience under their belt, it can be shocking the first time you get it so that makes a lot of sense, that saying, okay, we have a pathway to take this person and make them, get them to understand that, you know, there's bits of critical thinking in that, decision-making, communication skills, there's like little bits and pieces in there that makes a lot of sense.
Another thing that pops up is just the design for mentorship, right? So like how can we make the process and path to mentor so that when we do have somebody who can transfer their highly technical insights to a junior individual, yeah, we're not trying to create a learning module to teach those technical insights, but we can design the structure to help the mentor transfer that information with incurring the fewest number of like hour to hours spent, right? So we can also have them working on their technical components as well.
That makes a lot of sense. So from the talent development perspective, it's kind of like, maybe there's a bit of teaching people how to be a mentor in that, but then also maybe just like kind of providing the structure of what does a mentorship program look like? Maybe there's some software involved. Maybe just like, how often do you touch base? Maybe how should conversations go? That makes a lot of sense, because then, yeah, again, and I think this is one of the challenges that L&D falls into a lot is when people come to us with a problem, like, we want to be the ones finding the solution. Like, we want to be the solution rather than like providing the framework for the solution so that you can kind of like solve it yourself. I think we miss that a decent amount, probably because, you know, like in times where like leadership development, for example, often when you stand up a leadership development program, the L&D team is meant to be like the experts in leadership, you know, like that. So they're the facilitators. They're the ones that's doing it all. And if that's your mentality for all these technical domains, you're just going to be like, forget about it. When you can still, there's still something that we can bring to the table of here's some tools that we can provide you to make you better able at supporting yourself. That makes a lot of sense. Brian, anything come to mind for you?
Yeah, I think a big area that some companies could do a lot better to support their needs in this area is being crystal clear on what their company culture is and crystal clear on what they value in their teammates. Like, you can do this by, even if you're, you know, been around for a couple few years, or even if you just have a founding team, like look at what's been successful in those teammates or at the company so far. What are the key characteristics? What are the key traits that got you there and is consistent across the organization? And like really highlight that in like culture statements, and then also and in your hiring and in your talent development processes. Like, don't try to be everything at once. No organization can be everything at once, but know who you are, know your identity, and keep aligning that throughout hiring and talent development. Like, one of my favorite like Elon quotes or references ever is kind of the idea that a company is the sum of its vectors, right? It's not just how big of a vector you are, how much you get done. It's like, what direction are you also pointing? And so making sure that everyone's pointing in the same direction and you know how you're operating is huge.
Yeah. Again, as you were talking through that and this idea of like making sure you bring in the culture, it sparked in me because when I think a lot about having culture and having some kind of like onboarding process to get people in on the culture, it reminds me of turnover and especially early turnover and the challenges of turnover. You know, for you, when you all are, I guess, how much do you have to fight against that in organizations? I mean, you're dealing with relatively, you know, highly mission driven, relatively small organization. So maybe it's not as much as an issue for the folks that you're working with, but I don't know whether it's companies you work with or broader, more broadly, how hard of a factor is that to overcome, just that like early hire attrition? Because I keep hearing about how it's kind of rising throughout the world.
Yeah, it's definitely a key factor, and it's something that we work on a lot. So kind of to look at this from the angle that we see it a lot is a lot of like staffing agencies, which is kind of like we don't identify as a staffing agency, right? We do executive and highly technical headhunting. Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. That you're not just like, it's not just bringing a bunch of people. Got it.
Right. We're not bringing a bunch of people. It's not butts in seats. It's like a strategic, who are we looking for? Yeah. How do we find them? Like, we're not going to like, hey, please apply. Right. Like people aren't applying for the jobs, but almost exclusively aren't applying to the jobs. What we'll see is a lot of organizations that do kind of like similar things to us. They almost have like sales people as recruiters, right? They're trying to like sell the job. And there's definitely a component of what we do, which is like getting people excited about the role. But we also do a lot of like door in the face work where we go like, this is not going to be a good fit for you if you are XYZ. And that doesn't mean that you're bad, but your style, right? If your style can't fit with the style of the company, like this is not going to be a good fit. And we want to screen you out early, right? We're going to waste everybody's time if we get you into the seat and this was a mismatch. So like there's some like easy examples to point to. We've talked about pace, right? That's an easy one. Another one, especially if people coming from legacy companies, engineers, as you both know better than I do even, love to get things right. Right? They like for things to be done the right way. They know the numbers, you want the numbers to add up. You know, like they've got a concept of like black and white, what's right, what's wrong. And with startups, when we're looking at potentially pulling people from legacy orgs, it can be like, yeah, I'm gonna get it right. I gotta get it right. Insert funny joke about Boeing. Okay. We got to go slow because we got to get it right. But at startups, it's like, yes, we want to get it right. Sometimes we want to get to our first iteration and it's okay if it breaks because we're going to learn a lot from it breaking. And when you're pulling somebody from a Raytheon, right, like getting that concept can be really difficult. They could say, yeah, I like to work at a really fast pace. But then when you get into it and you go, would you be okay building something that's going to break because you got to build it fast? And it's like, whoa, no, that like goes against my identity. Right. And so I say all that to say that, figuring out how to get a clear vision of what does work really well, who does work really well at this organization. And one, making sure that's what you want it to look like, right? So getting a clear snapshot, what works really well, and then going, you know, senior leadership, is this an accurate representation? Otherwise, we need to change some things. And then being able to take that and communicate it to talent, because it's so expensive in time and money and resources to be getting people into the seat that aren't going to fit.
It's interesting because I think, again, reflecting back on a lot of my experiences, you know, what I'm hearing from you is just the importance of, not only from you, Brian, like the importance of having that really clear culture, but then, which can often come from a talent development organization. But we spend all of our time focusing on the employees and we kind of start at day one, you know, and how do we get people going there? but it would be incredibly helpful for us to, because I think quite frankly, would just say, okay, now recruiting, you go figure it out. And recruiting goes and does their own thing, and they like look at the culture, and then, but having both teams talking together through that entire creation process, because you're right. I mean, I remember, I forget his name. There's some computer engineer. He's written a few books on dating, and he was talking about how in the dating world, what you really want to do is lean in as much as possible to your weirdest qualities. Like if you're a nerd, own the fact that you're a nerd. If you're into Star Trek, like all of your pictures should be in Star Trek, because though that is going to dramatically decrease the pool of people who are out there who find you interesting, the people in that pool are like, this is my thing, right? And so then it's great. And to your point, I've definitely been at companies where their recruiting team was much more of a sales org, and it was much more of a mentality of, no, we want to be, you know, if we're in the office, we don't want to say we're in the office in the beginning. We want to wait and kind of like get them talking to us first. And then once they're in love with us, we'll be like, oh, by the way, we're in the office. But now they're going to love us, so it'll be okay. And it's like, nah, I don't know if that's a good strategy.
Right. Exactly. I think first of all, that was my strategy with dating, and it worked really well with Brian. So he's my co-founder and husband.
You found the nerd.
Yeah. exactly. Like being able to be able to see and then be able to communicate your true culture. Another good example of this, we did a pod on our podcast. We had Hans Konigsman, and yeah. And we were talking about kind of the culture at SpaceX, and talking about like how many working tons of hours, and it was a really fun conversation. And a friend of mine texted me and was like, "Hey, it was a really great podcast, but I just thought, like, you know, it's like really bad that SpaceX has that culture that like people have to like work so long, and they would see their boss like coming in before them and leaving after them. It sets like a really intense example." And I was like, bad. Like it's not good for you, and that's great that you know that, right? But how sad would it be if there wasn't a place like this, and the people who wanted to work like that, now they don't have a home, right? That's now we're removing all the diversity of these companies to make it so that they fit everyone, and then it makes it so that nobody has a home that really fits them. And there are people who thrive in that SpaceX culture. Yeah. And yeah, there are people who get burnt out super fast. That's okay. Like that's good. And we would want, how terrible would it be then if somebody's interviewing at SpaceX and we're going, oh, work like 40 hours a week, right? Yeah. Work like that, right? Like we wouldn't want to represent it that way. We want to say, you're going to work with some of the smartest, most intense people in the world. You're going to put your literal blood, sweat, and tears into this organization, and you're going to achieve things that nobody on the planet has ever achieved before. You're going to scare the bejesus out of a bunch of people, and you're going to light the fire inside of others. And like, that's the goal.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I know, speaking for myself, I honestly, when I first started working at SpaceX, it was really hard for me. Like I felt it was almost unfair because I started working there right after my daughter was born. So she was 3 months old when I started. And I was really frustrated for a really long time because it was like, this company is everything I want it to be. Like I'm deeply passionate about space. I want to be pushing it, but the only way to like really like stand out and move forward is just by putting in these crazy hours. And I'm not in a position where I want to put in those crazy hours. And I was like really frustrated by that. And then I grew up and kind of realized that not everyone needs to be able to work everywhere. That's, you know, and it's great that we have different people will thrive in different environments, exactly like you said. And that's fine. And that's great. You know?
Yeah. This is all so very well said already, but like another way to quick paraphrase this is like, be brutally honest about who you are to yourself. And then be brutally honest about who you are to others. And you don't need to apologize for that. And that's what will, like circling back to the beginning, like that's where attrition comes from, is if someone starts and it's not what they expect, or you're changing the job on them, or this, that, and the other, like that's why people leave. people don't leave because it's what they thought it was going to be. Like, that's pretty rare, right? Like, it's because it's not what they thought it would be.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. To kind of end this note or put a cherry on the top, maybe there's not a way to do what I'm going to try to do right now. So feel free to tell me if I'm putting you in an unfair spot. But kind of one of the things that we try to do here, one of the arcs, especially for talent development people, is to try to figure out, okay, like from the talent acquisition perspective, how can we help prove the worth of talent development? Like, what are the things that talent development can do that'll be most valuable to talent acquisition and help improve it? And so if a talent development team is focusing on these things of, you know, having the important, you know, really defining culture really well, making sure it's woven into the process, making sure we're teaching these like critical, we have a pathway for teaching critical thinking and decision-making and communication. I don't know if I can ask you for a number because that seems a little absurd, but I don't know. Just what's your sense of how much that would be worth to an organization to have those boxes checked? How much better or simpler or faster could it potentially make their talent acquisition process?
I mean, I think an easy number for companies to calculate, is to look at what is early attrition. What does early attrition look like, right? And like that's a way to calculate numbers. If you go, hey, if we have a team that's able to create a really strong program for bringing people into our organization, like, you know, if we're able to reduce early attrition, now we just have dollar amounts we can put to it, right? So it's like there's a formula that we can look at. I think another way to look at numbers, like, so and this is something an idea I was hanging on from earlier in our conversation, I'll loop back to it and bring them back together, but another way that I think talent development can really support organizations, and again, especially speaking about where our mind frame is in this niche of space startups, clean tech startups, is we're often looking for these, we call it like the heads of this role that comes in early in a startup. They need to be able to do the thing, right? They have to be technical enough to do the thing with their own brain, their own hands, their own computer. And then they also have to be strategic enough to make a plan for the future. And they need to have the leadership skills in order to grow a team under them. That's a lot of areas of expertise, right? And you're not owning one tiny piece. You're owning like a whole department. You're like doing a whole department, right? Technically, strategically, and growing a team. And this is this golden person we're looking for frequently. And it's tough because you usually have to snag them from another startup because otherwise it's too many things. People don't have at bats for that many things regularly in order to develop being a seasoned expert in all of those different things. So creating talent development outlines that supports in the leadership and the leadership component of that so that you can take somebody who's technically excellent and build them into a leader because you've got some time, right? It's not a long time, but you've got some time to develop them into a leader before they need to be growing those people. It really opens up the talent pool to who we're able to bring on. If we go, cool, we need somebody who is technically excellent, who can see the big picture, but we're confident that we're going to be able to grow them into a leader, like that's a big lever. That would be a big a lever for us to pull.
To add to that, like, we've found that so many of these startups, right, they're taking big swings. 90% of startups fail. Like, you got to take big swings. You got to take risks. And part of that is a little bit in hiring and talent development, right? You can hire, we sometimes call it like the sequel, right? You can hire someone who's already done it before and they're going to come back and they're going to do it again. And it's going to be the sequel, right? But how often is a sequel anywhere close to as good as the first hit, right? And so what we're really looking for is like, who's primed to make that like box office hit, like once they're hired. And you don't know, you have to take some risks. But if you can, on the talent acquisition side, know how to identify that potential and pair that with talent development, who can increase the probability of that person following through to deliver something really special, that's worth, like, that's the make or break of a company, right? Like, the vast majority of these companies, they have ideas that can work. It's about executing them fast enough and cheap enough. And that, so much of that comes down to having the right talent who's, like, ready and developed properly. And so I also think you could put a dollar sign on that, right? If you could say,
for sure,
I can take someone who hasn't done this before and I can ensure some level of increased probability of success, like, based on having done it before, like, now you're delivering tons of value.
You're both making me feel really good. So at the end of last year, I spent some time sitting down, thinking through and creating this framework that I call the Talent Launch System. It's meant to be like a four-step approach of how to create a talent development system that, like, really focuses on impacting the business. And I call it the Talent Launch System because it's got this big play off of a rocket analogy. So it's like the first one is stage zero, then stage, the first stage and second stage and everything. And so the first three stages are, first is streamline compliance training, because it's actually a really simple box that you can check really quickly. But a lot of companies, they just spend way too much time and energy, mainly time, trying to do really bad compliance training. Then number two is hiring and interviewing training, so that you're making sure the people you're bringing in are really good. And then number three is manager training. So it sounds like, you know, those kinds of things are, at least a few of them are roughly aligned with a lot of what you are talking about. So that's awesome. Amazingly, over a half hour has already gone by. Something that I didn't think to ask you before, but I would love to, quick question to kind of throw out at you, since you get to work with such interesting teams doing amazing things. What is the most interesting role that you've ever hired for, if one pops into your head?
Really interesting. We have so many interesting roles. I'm like, so many things are coming to mind for so many different reasons. We partner with Varda Space, and we were hiring their head of mechanisms. We needed somebody that was able to create mechanisms in, like, that work in zero G. And so getting to speak to people who have that technical expertise. And the company was very early at that time, which is a really fun time to get to talk to, because the people who get it, and the people who don't, right? And we can talk to them about it till we're blue in the face, and we do. And sometimes you can get people excited about it that don't understand it when you're first starting the conversation. But that was a really cool technical role that is also working on in-space manufacturing, and so it's just everything about it was really exciting.
Excellent. Brian, have you found yours?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. There's too many. I guess I'll touch on a couple, which both coincidentally happen to be in the Bay Area. But one of them was a kind of like payload RF, like radio frequency person, who's just so specific, and they're such tricky people to find and hire for. And we got the job, and we were hearing about it, and we were just like, oh, that's this person. We interviewed this person before. And being able to, like, call that person up who's making way more money at a bigger company and convince them, like, no, this is the job that you've always wanted. Like, you should move again. You just started this job. You're making way more, but you should move again because this is the job for you. And then, like, making that happen was super cool. And another, like, employee number one head of propulsion role a year ago was a blast, kind of a similar thing of being like, oh, this, we're going to find a place for this. And this is an exceptionally fun problem to solve, and being able to make that match. And, you know, kind of these department heads, if you will, that are highly technical, but can do so much more than that. Like, that's where so much of the fun has been for us.
And if I can add on to what Brian's saying, there is, part of what's so like, we love people. we love people, we love space, we love clean tech. Like, that's why we do this. And so part of what is so energizing and so magical about the work that we're doing is we're developing this database of all the relevant people in our industry, and not just what they can do technically, not just what's on their resume, but like, what lights a fire inside them? What are they motivated by? What is going to be their game-changing next role? And like, so for that, you know, RF engineer, Brian was mentioning, it was really cool to be able to give him a call, right? Call him up, and we were like, hey, we found it. And he was like, no, I, like, things are good. I'm at this big tech company. Like, it's good. And I was like,
no, really?
We found it. Let me send it to you. And he's like, okay, I'll take a look. Calls me that day. And he was like, I think you're right. Like, let's talk, like, let's get it in. And it was like the fastest interview process. And he's so happy there. Right. And so being that's able so to cool. like, we're not collecting resumes. We're like collecting dreams. It's a very cheesy way of putting it, but like,
that's a tagline. That is a tagline, right? Right? At Astra, we don't collect resumes. We collect dreams.
Yeah. Like, And it was the same with the other example, right? You talk to these people, you go, well, what is the thing that would, you know, light a fire inside of you? And then you maybe it's a year later, but when we find it, we can call them up and go, we found it. Let's go.
That's neat. And that's the thing I love about the startup. There's so many things I love about kind of like the startup, especially like the space startup space, is that one, being in startup world means you're accepting massive swings, you know, so it's hard. It can be depressing. It can be, you can have like mental breakdowns, but man, the highs are so high. Like the high, they're just, the wins couldn't be bigger. But I'm always amazed. Cause like since leaving SpaceX, I stayed in the LA area, and now I just like, I know people at all the cool companies. Like I know a bunch of people at Relativity. I know a bunch of people at Rocket Lab. I know, you know, that like, it's amazing how small and tight knit a community it really is. So I'm sure for you, getting to know those people, you can just have this community, this pool to pull from. That I mean, I'll be honest, I'll say it, like I envy you of like the niche that you have found and what you're going for. Like I just can't imagine like the amazing conversations you must get to have about this, especially in the world. You know, the other thing I like about the fact that I was working at SpaceX and that stuff is there's so many things going, it's so easy to turn on the news, get really down on the world. But like in our sphere, like there's just every reason to be amazingly hopeful about the future. Like we can solve all the problems. We can do it all. We can feed everybody. We can go to other planets. We can do it all. Like it's neat.
That is so well put. It's a really excellent point.
So to close it out here, I do want to finish with a couple quick questions. One, what is one book that you would recommend everyone read and why? Or podcast suggestion, one or the other.
Oh my gosh. I'm laughing because I won't shut up about Atomic Habits by James Clear. It's my favorite book. It's right behind me. I'm obsessed with Atomic Habits. It's all about building an intentional life and doing so through not just like muscling and willpower, but using your neurobiology to create systems that your system responds well to, so you can create habits for yourself.
I love it. Brian, do you have one?
Atomic Habits too. Like I don't consume nearly as much as Seika does. Like she consumes so much good stuff on this stuff. And that's been one of my favorites. Usually I'm not like that into kind of like the personal development type stuff. Like and that one just really, really clicked with me and felt very, very practical and helped me understand my brain and how to make things better and how you can do things that makes your life worse without you really realizing it. And so I guess we're kind of accidental Atomic Habit geeks over in our household over here.
I love it. I need to just finally do it. Despite my bookshelf behind me, I have not read Atomic Habits yet. And I think it's just because I hear so many people talking about it. I'm like, oh, okay, like it's like the thing. But everybody keeps telling me it's like a great book. So I should actually read it. What is one skill that has, you know, I focus a lot whenever I talk about training, I talk about behaviors, I talk about skills. What skill has most helped you succeed in your life?
I think the thing that comes up for me is dedication over motivation. So, we can love motivation to get us started and have that big bang of dopamine when we like come up with a new plan. And I think for me, I've created kind of like a piece of my identity is keeping my eyes set on the goal, regardless of motivation fluctuating, right? Or the energy for that thing fluctuating. Keep going when the time gets tough.
Excellent. And come up for you, Brian. See you thinking.
Brian has so many skills that make him excellent at what he does. Some that stand out to me are he sees details much more he thoughtfully, and he just sees them better, more quickly than a lot of people. And I think that has made him really excellent at a lot of what he does. He sees details, he sees when things are off, and he's able to point to them and articulate what they are. He's also really thoughtful in relationships. So like he takes a lot of care and love with the relationships that he's handling. And it's really a useful skill in business. And I think that can be overlooked a lot. But it, you know, if you want people to have a dopamine release when they interact with you, you want to make the world better throughout each of your interactions, right? It's a key piece of being successful at what we do.
Absolutely. And that's why everybody needs a good partner to pick them up and remind them of like, hey, you're doing good.
Yeah. Thank you. That was very, very kind. I just got to sit back and hear words of praise. So thank you.
Awesome. Well, this has been great. I think, like I said, I was really looking forward to this conversation because I don't think the talent development and talent acquisition worlds mix enough. And so hopefully this provided a little bit of push to some of the talent development folks out there of like, hey, you can help the talent acquisition folks. They there's real ways that you can improve it. Start talking to them, get to know them a little bit better. So thank you so much for being on today. I wish you all the luck with Ad Astra. Like I said, I'm jealous of the conversation. Don't get me wrong, I love my job, but you got some pretty good stuff going on there. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having us. Really impressive stuff that you're doing. And it's a true pleasure getting to connect with you. Every time we speak, I'm like, I feel like I just drank a coffee. I'm ready to go take over the world.
Awesome.
Yeah, thanks so much, Matt. This was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. If you liked the discussion, make sure to hit like and subscribe so you never miss an episode. As a reminder, if your team is struggling keeping up with the training development demands of your organization, we want to help. Better Everyday Studios is a full-service instructional design team that can help you with everything from ideation to actual content creation and delivery. Please reach out to us using the link in the episode notes below. Have a great day.